In Kenya, many people are named for the season in which they were born. Accordingly, you'll find a lot of Kenyans named Wanjela. The word means hunger, or the hunger season, the time of year when poor farmers are waiting for their crops to mature but don't have enough food for themselves. Today on Focus, my guest Roger Thoreau will talk about an effort to eliminate the hunger season among small farmers in Africa. In his book, The Last Hunger Season, Thoreau follows four farming families as they take part in a program giving them access to new seed and new farming techniques. Does the program work? We'll find out more today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. And welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The term Green Revolution refers to a dramatic increase in food production that was achieved in many parts of the developing world during the latter half of the 20th century, and that was thanks to new crop varieties, fertilizers, irrigation, and other farming techniques. These developments are credited with saving over a billion people from starvation, according to Wikipedia, in much of Asia, the Indian subcontinent, Turkey, the Philippines. But the Green Revolution has made much less headway in Africa, where subsistence farming is too often the norm. My guest today on Focus is Roger Thoreau. He's a former Wall Street Journal reporter, now a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And last year, he wrote about one group's efforts in Kenya to help small-share farmers in western Kenya break the bonds of subsistence farming with a green revolution of their own. The book is called The Last Hunger Season, A Year in an African Farm Community on the Brink of Change. It's published by Public Affairs, and Thoreau will be at the University of Illinois Bookstore today, Tuesday, for a noon hour Author's Corner presentation. He's with us right now on Focus. Mr. Thoreau, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Glad to be here.
And before I forget, I invite your calls for Roger Thoreau at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, and you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, I just mentioned the Green Revolution, which was an important phenomenon in the last century, but why didn't it spread over Africa the way it did over, say, parts of Asia?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, as you said, you were kind of recounting some of the successes of the Green Revolution, really knocking back famine or conquering famine into places back then in the 50s and 60s and early 70s that were kind of the true basket cases of the world then. So India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, kind of rolling famines in those places. And a success there in those countries, other places in Asia, moving up to China, then what was going on in Brazil and the agriculture development there, that all of a sudden these places became places of surplus harvest, emerging agriculture superpowers. And I guess the world basically said, okay, gee, the Green Revolution was a success, kind of problem solved, patted itself on the back, awarded Norman Borlaug, kind of known as the father of the Green Revolution, a plant breeder from Iowa, the Nobel Peace Prize, and kind of, okay, problem solved. We then entered this relatively long period of cheap and abundant food throughout the world, and the Green Revolution never made it to Africa in terms of agriculture development, and so kind of the international development just went along, and it was, we don't need to really transform agriculture in Africa because there's enough that's growing.
The idea was that there was enough food aid coming into Africa to keep people going, even though their own farming practices were not sustainable?
Absolutely. So that was part of the thinking or the prevailing kind of Washington consensus or international development consensus at the time, that places like Africa, other places in the developing world, say like Haiti and others, that, hey, you know, your smallholder farmers, your peasant farmers, they're probably better off in industry or, you know, textile business or something, making things that we don't make in the United States anymore, selling that for hard currency, and then buying the food, say, that's being grown in the United States. So the rice from, say, Texas or Arkansas, our farmers are subsidized. We can do it cheaper. You know, the prices are low. You can buy our food. Oh, and then if you're hungry, and you can't afford that, well, we'll feed you with our food aid. And so kind of a very kind of damaging set of constructs for the well-being of, say, the smallholder farmers in Africa. So instead of the pendulum swung far towards food aid and food relief as opposed to agriculture development aid, so these farmers were able to produce enough food to feed themselves and not need food aid to begin with.
Did that model, if you can call it a model, of having food aid at the ready and being ready to sell food at all times, did that model just fall apart in recent years?
Yeah, I think not necessarily fall apart, but I think what we started to realize, and particularly for myself and the reporting I was doing for the Wall Street Journal, say in 2003, with the Ethiopian famine, it was the first famine of the first large great famine of the 21st century of the new millennium. 14 million people were on the doorstep of starvation, being kept alive if they were to survive at all by international food aid that was coming into the country. And the weird circumstance about that is that that famine had been preceded by 2 years of bumper harvest, some of the best harvest that farmers in Ethiopia had ever had. But because markets hadn't been developed, there had really been no kind of agriculture development with infrastructure, with the distribution of it, with the markets. After 2 years of these surpluses, they built up, prices collapsed 80% of some of the commodities in parts of the country. So catastrophic. And so that food, there was no kind of market internally for that food. So that was being stored in warehouses by the farmers, by the traders, because if that would have gone on the market, prices would have collapsed even further. And here then came this international food aid, largely from the United States. And hooray for that, because it kept countless number of people alive, but it was streaming into the country past these warehouses full of Ethiopian-grown food, and something wasn't right in that picture. It was like, why can't our food aid system kind of buy the food that's available, assist these farmers in becoming more productive, so that when they do have harvest and great surplus, the prices aren't collapsing, they can actually get a profit from it, their incentive continues. So I think it was kind of at that moment, so about that time that one started realizing, yeah, there's something is wrong with the way international development has gone with agriculture development aid, and how is it that we brought hunger with us into the 21st century?
Well, thinking of those questions and really the troubling things that you were reporting for the Wall Street Journal a few years ago, it's interesting to see a book like this, which is actually very optimistic. This mm-hmm. is a book about what seems to be good news, finding a program that seems, at least on some scale, to work in terms of not just alleviating hunger, but essentially giving the small farmers the ability to support themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I wanted to show or hope to show in the reporting of this book. And so I spent a year with four smallholder farmers in Western Kenya.
You spent a year in Western Kenya?
Yeah, I went back and forth, say, six or seven times during the course of the year, and the trips were between, you know, 2.5 weeks and four and a half weeks or so during the crucial times of their the growing season. So it was from January to December, kind of going through the growing season and the harvest and the markets of it and things at the end or towards the end of the year. And what I wanted to capture was, one, the lifestyle of these farmers and these smallholder farmers who make up the majority of the population in most African countries, and particularly in Kenya. They produce most of the food in Africa, but yet their lives and the way they live is basically the words that I use to describe their farms, which they call shambas. The way they do life were basically the same words in the famous book Out of Africa by Karen Blixen, and she wrote that in the 1930s about the farmers that were on her farm in Kenya back then, and the famous line, "I had a farm in Africa." And I said, these farmers are toiling in such a time warp. I really wanted to write about them, but then also to show, hey, what happens? What is their potential? What is their promise? What can they do when these essential elements of farming that we all take for granted, access to better quality seeds, soil nutrients, financing, critical to farmers all over the world, but really hadn't been available to these farmers. Markets, infrastructure.
Insurance was one of the things that struck me.
Precisely. So a crop insurance that's built into kind of the microfinancing to make available to them, that when they have that, what can they do? And as one sees in the book, there's a doubling, tripling, quadrupling of their yields of maize, their main staple crop, which they grow during the long rainy season. For one of the farmers, it was a tenfold increase in her harvest. And kind of imagine that when just within one season you have this doubling, tripling, quadrupling, a tenfold increase in what is your main source of income. So the transformation is remarkable. And that's what I kind of wanted to show, that when one shifts this pendulum from, hey, these are hungry farmers, let's give them food aid. No, let's provide to them or create the conditions of agriculture development so these farmers are able to feed themselves and feed their families.
My guest today is Roger Thoreau. He is author of The Last Hunger Season, and he will be talking and signing books at noon today at the University of Illinois Bookstore on Wright Street on the U of I Urbana campus. My apologies to our evening listeners. I'm afraid the signing's already happened, and you'll be both talking and signing books, so you'll be giving a talk about the subject of The Last Hunger Season?
I will, yes. The subject of The Last Hunger Season and some of the farmers and characters in the book.
If you have questions or comments, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's introduce just for a moment. Your book focuses on these four farm families and these four farmers, but they are all working with this one organization, an NGO, a non-governmental organization called the One Acre Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me a little bit about that group and just exactly what their goals are and what their game plan is.
Right. So the One Acre Fund started in, I think, 2006 or so when Andrew Yoon, was kind of the founder of the organization. He was getting his MBA at Northwestern, at the Kellogg School of Management and Business at Northwestern. And he was in Africa doing some work on AIDS programs and looking at how those systems could kind of be streamlined for the doctors, the clinicians, the people working with the HIV/AIDS sufferers to basically widen their net and increase the number of people that they could treat and work with. And so those were kind of, that was in South Africa and kind of in the more of the urban areas. But he was very curious also about the conditions of rural Africa. Somebody suggested, well, you know, he had a friend or something, to go to Western Kenya. And he went there kind of on this fortuitous trip. And when he was there, he just noticed a difference in smallholder farmers. Some smallholder farmers were reasonably prospering. They had enough food to eat through the whole season or through the whole year. Their children were in school. They were dressed better. There was no malnutrition in the family. But then maybe some families right next door or in the immediate area were just having an awful time. Their kids were hungry and malnourished. They didn't have enough money to send their kids to school or to dress properly, to kind of wearing rags. They were kind of in this kind of almost perpetual hunger season. And what the hunger season is it's this period of the time of the year between when the food from the previous harvest runs out and the next harvest comes in. So the food's either been eaten, so consumed by the family, or sold for medical expenses, malaria treatment, for school fees, for whatever that they would sell it for some other different kind of food to diversify their diets. So this period, and this period of this hunger season can last maybe from a month, a couple of weeks, or a month, or can stretch for several months, or for one of the farmers and families in the book for 9 months. And so Andrew was looking at that and figuring, this is incomprehensible. Why is this happening? Why are there these differences between these families? What's going on? Why do we have this what I think, and talking to Andrew, kind of that he was also sharing this feeling, Africa's cruelest irony is that her hungriest people are her smallholder farmers. So this whole notion of hungry farmers, which should be an oxymoron, hungry farmers don't go together, but it was a reality and a truism for so many farmers in Africa. How could farmers themselves be hungry and their families? And so that's what he wanted to get to. And with his business education and kind of looking at distribution patterns and studying that and kind of the introduction of new products and things to companies in the United States. He started putting that mindset or looking at these agriculture problems through that prism, and he just figured that one of the missing links of African agriculture, because the agriculture development and the Green Revolution kind of never blossoming in Africa, was this inability to access these essential elements of farming. I mean, that was the difference between farmers that were doing better and those that were kind of in the depths of this hunger season all the time. Just access to, as I said before, seeds, soil nutrients, financing, and crop insurance and things. And so that's what he started to provide.
And also certain farming practices as well that they just were not aware of. I was struck.
Extension advice.
Yeah, later in the book they find out that the Kenyan Ministry of Agriculture has an extension, and so they must have been doing something trying to educate farmers on how to be more self-sufficient, but there was still just a big gap.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think of how critical extension agents have been in Illinois agriculture and Midwest agriculture down through the years and the decades, they understand that, and they realize that in Africa, the importance of that. So the newest technology and how does one employ that deploy that on the farms. So the Kenyan Ministry of Agriculture, a number of African countries, they'll all have kind of extension agents, but then they're lacking the money to basically put them into action. So there's so many places in Africa where you see that the extension agents don't even have bicycles to get out to the farmers. So if you're walking, how many farmers can you actually visit in the course of a day? If you have a bicycle and the roads are rutted and they're dirt roads and it's maybe the rainy season, well, how else do you get out? So it's kind of this sharing of information. So that's one other thing that the One Acre Fund then started to do, was just simple agriculture extension advice. Plant in straight rows, proper spacing between the crops,
Before they were just sort of broadcasting their seed. Mm-hmm. And we know, of course, we know what broadcasting is here at a radio station, but the original term broadcasting is really just flinging it out there.
Exactly. So they would just dig furrows, and then they would cast their seed as if they're feeding chickens or throwing dice. And their thinking was, well, okay, gee, if there's 2, 3, 4 seeds that are like close to each other, kind of in the same area or the same hole, well, that's pretty good because at least one of them will grow. But as we know, yeah, they'll all start growing. But then at a certain stage, they are in competition with each other for the soil nutrients, for the water, for the sun, for the space. And they all end up being stunted and yield nothing. So what they were saying is 1 seed per hole. So that's common knowledge to any of us or to backyard gardeners in the United States or in the rich countries of the world. But there it was like a cultural difference and kind of a revolutionary thought. 1 seed per hole, proper spacing.
That's one thing that struck me, because you said there were more prosperous farmers in Kenya. Some of them must have knew about these practices, but at the same time, others did not, and maybe simply because of habit or whatever, there may have been even some resistance to these ideas as to whether or not they would actually work.
Yep, exactly. And so it's kind of, even when the One Acre Fund went and started and was like, okay, so here's extension advice. I mean, they were working with some scientists and extension people in Kenya who had been working with farmers. And again, it's like, and I think also true here, the extension information is much more easily embraceable if it's by somebody who's in your community or somebody that you know or that you're comfortable with. And this person who I respect and trust is telling me to do it this way. Maybe I'm a little skeptical, but I'll try, or I'll see how it's working for them. So in their first years, they were really kind of relying on, say, the early adapters, people who say, we've got to do something. And so some of these farmers that are in this hunger season for 6, 8, 9 months of the year, they're like, they're desperate to try anything. Okay, let's try this and see what happens. And then they saw the change that can come. And otherwise, some of them, they would buy their seed, maybe a little bit of fertilizer, so microdosing of fertilizer, but it didn't get very far in their plots, their quarter acre, half acre, 1 acre plots or something. And so they weren't even maximizing the land that they have to plant.
So the One Acre Fund was sort of offering a complete program in terms of seed and supplies and also best practices. And I understand that it wasn't free. The farmers were paying for it, so it wasn't just a gift. Was there a financial backing that the One Acre Fund had to get started? Were the farmers paying the entire cost or just part of it?
Yeah, and that's a critical part of their thinking, that, yeah, it can't, that they were figuring, we're not going to give anything away, the we being them, because that's not sustainable. And people have seen that over and over in these communities in Africa where other organizations have come in or mission groups or other groups, very well-meaning, and they'll give things away. But when they leave, then, well, what's there for the next year? Fine, you gave me seed and some the essentials of farming now, but what happens when you go? And so what the 1 Acre Fund wanted to do with what they call their market bundle is to provide the seeds, the microdosing amounts of fertilizer and the soil nutrients. This is extension advice, and have a loan package in there, so microfinancing. So the equivalent of, say, $40 for a half an acre, maybe $80, $75 or so for an entire acre, and that the farmers then would pay it back, you know, kind of over time with a little bit a week. For them, it was the first time that they were being introduced to credit, to financing. Mm-hmm. They had never had that before. And if you think of farmers anywhere else in the world, credit financing is the lifeblood of their operations.
Yeah, for good, sometimes for ill, but often, mm-hmm. but other times for good.
Exactly. And so once they learn about that if I pay this loan back, these guys will be here to operate next year. So when they're demonstrating this for the first time, it's a great scene that they bring in a bucket of water, and they give, and one farmer gives that to another farmer. This is a present for you. That bucket of water, representing the elements of farming. She then goes outside of or to the side of where they're meeting. She throws the bucket of water on the ground. Okay, I've used that. She comes back and her bucket is empty. If they're not there the next year to give them another full bucket of water or these essential elements of farming, they're not going to be able to operate. So they show, here's what happens with financing. Here's a bucket of water. And then with a cup, they basically take the water from that bucket and transfer it to another water, to another bucket. We're transferring the water. These are your monthly or your weekly payments of paying back. You still have this bucket of water. So the next year, we're still using that. And then you repay that. And that is this fund that's this money that's there. But the 1 Acre Fund, for the startup funds, they did have backing from social enterprise organizations in Silicon Valley, other places, who are really interested
mostly
in agriculture development.
From private sources, huh?
Yes.
Interesting. We have a caller, if you want to put your headphones mm-hmm. on, and we'll say hello to Lawrence from Savoy. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I have a serious head cold here, as you might be able to tell. I wanted to ask a question about the roots of all of this. Now, obviously, these financial features have their mental aspects in that, but I wanted to focus more on the agriculture thing. Just to save time, I'll just be politically not correct and very blunt. Why are these people so dumb? Why do they not figure out on their own that, you know, if your plants suffer because two or three grow close together, why didn't they figure out on their own one hole for one seed? What's going on?
Yeah, I think if you think of these are practices that are you know, traditional and generational, and they're able to you know, grow a little bit, but in their kind of communities, they're not realizing what their potential is. There's kind of nobody had come along and said, gee, if you try something different, you can kind of double or triple your yields. They're figuring, well, this is the way it is. It's the way that it's always been. And I think if you think back, say, the history of agriculture in Illinois and the Midwest, it was really important for the agricultural extension agents who would also come along and say, hey, try this type of seed. Here's the best way to maximize your yields on that. So it's not a question of them being dumb or bad farmers. I mean, that they're able to, particularly with the poor soil conditions and things, that they're able to kind of get anything out of their farms is remarkable in many instances. But I think what it boils down to is that, you know, it this is the way that they had done things for so long. It was their tradition, their culture, the way of farming like this. And so they weren't aware of the possibilities and potential that would be out there.
Lawrence, thank you for your call.
Lawrence.
You met with these people personally. You're not talking about these folks in the abstract, because you did focus on four farm families and four farmers and four people who were trying this program for the first time. What incentive did you get from these four folks, I guess the early adopters, as you mentioned earlier, as to their feelings about these new practices and why they had done things the old way for so long.
Yeah, I think that when they saw that they become very enthusiastic and kind of then very eager then to share it with others. So the 1 Acre Fund, they started in 2006, I believe it was, with Andrew started with 40 farmers that he was starting to work with. And then now they're working with over 130,000 farmers. I mean, so it's kind of by word of mouth, by seeing, hey, what are you doing? How are you doing this? I think also in relation to Lawrence's earlier question, you know, one of the reasons is they're doing all this work by hand. It's manual labor. It's backbreaking. You know, they're short-handled hoes that they're doing their planting with. The majority of the farmers are women, the smallholder farmers. The men may be out trying to find income in other areas, because this is like subsistence farming. It's a thing. Okay, it's a household task. The woman is doing that, growing just enough to feed the family.
Farming was seen in a different light than, say, American farming, where it's really the man's profession, and it is sort of like the man's doing this, and then traditionally the farmer's wife is running the household. But
right.
You're saying here the farm was so small that it's considered part of the household.
Yeah, exactly, and particularly the growing of, say, these of what were then seen as subsistence crops. So the maize, the beans, the food that the family itself is eating. If there's cash crops, so say the cocoa farmers, the farmers growing ginger or flowers, that is something that then the men would become more involved in, because it's money generating. And so it was like, okay, these are the subsistence crops that are to feed the family. That's kind of what the women are involved with. But the point I was making in terms of the hard labor it is, and that these women have so many other things that they're doing. These new practices that the 1 Acre Fund was introducing then is it's more time-consuming. It's more strenuous to measure your rows, to proper spacing. And although we might think of that, well, that's second nature, and that's easy enough to do when you're there and you have all these other things that are going on in your life, plus this is very hard work, bending over to make sure there's one seed per hole, that really becomes an additional heavy burden to do and really time-consuming. And if they're timing their planting by the rains and it's not mechanized, boy, they've got to do all this in a hurry in an optimal time. So to take that time to bend over and do this, to measure the rows and stuff, it's just that much more time-consuming. So it's more of a complicated answer when you're actually there and observing their life, their lifestyles and everything else that's involved, that's going on in their lives and the raising of the children and whatever livestock and things they have, that it's you can kind of understand why it is that they've just continued to do things as they had all the time.
Let's take another call on line one. Karen from Champaign, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Yeah, you've gone ahead and answered some of it, but I just wanted to add to the discussion regarding the gentleman's comment about, you know, why the people there are not very informed about how to do agriculture. You know, I think people forget in some of those communities, those people have almost no education, no access to books. They're often isolated, so they don't even have access to other kinds of, you know, other larger communities where maybe some type of practice is going on. And our agricultural practices here, you know, we've built it on several hundred years of information. I mean, you can even go back and look at George Washington, you know, almost 200 or over 200 years ago. And so he was doing advanced agricultural practice. He was an educated person who had wealth and access to a lot of resources around him that those people don't have. So when you don't have access to resources, you don't have wealth, you don't have education, you have overwhelming burdens with other things, like you've mentioned, just simply getting water every day, mm-hmm. then, you know, it's not surprising that they're not informed about these practices, because there's just no, it's like, you know, if you had never been taught wilderness survival, and you were sitting out in the woods by yourself, you know, how much could you teach yourself, and how much would you struggle, and then how fast would you end up dying because you didn't learn it fast enough? So I think that's something that, you know, people don't always realize. Some of these people have very low education and very low access to information about books, you know, books and other basic information about these things that we have had in this country for 200-300 years. And so it's becomes a given here, because even if you're, if you barely graduate from sixth grade in this country, you've probably read more books by the time you leave sixth grade than many of those people have ever read in their lifetimes. So that's all my comment is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Karen. And, you know, Roger, I'm struck by one of the families you write about, their son Gideon, who the family struggles to send to high school at the same time, and it's a real struggle in order to pay the high school tuition and at the same time just stay alive, really, on subsistence farming. But the son is really soaking up the education and getting an immediate interest in bringing it back to farming.
Yep, absolutely. And so their education, they really prize education, and that's their goal for their children. If they can get if we can get them into high school and have a high school education, and high school then in Kenya, that's when kind of the school fees start kicking in, or they're a little higher. The primary education, you know, there'll be some fees for taking tests and some doing some other things. But in high school, then there's kind of a tuition. In our terms, it might be like $200 a year or something. So we figured, well, that's not much. But again, consider their world. And these are the kind of the $1.50 a day people in terms of their income. Maybe their only income is selling the milk of the one or two cows that they have. And that they prize education. And in the case of Leonita, the farmer, and Gideon's mother, when I first met her in January, she was telling me she was beginning her second year with the 1 Acre Fund. Her first year, she had tripled her harvest. And so she now had enough, she grew enough that she could conquer the hunger season, feed her family, or have enough maize, corn, that would be enough to feed her family throughout the years and supplement it with other foods to diversify the diet. But when I first saw her, I said, gee, I really want to come to your house and see how you're storing the grain or the maize and you know, kind of tell me about that. And she said, Roger, I sold it. I said, what do you mean you sold it? She said, I sold it because I had to raise money because the school fees were coming. And this boy, Gideon, he was entering his third year of high school. Her three older children, they didn't have the wherewithal to send them to high school. This boy, he's been reading the Bible since he's been early, which would be like one of the only books they would have around the house. He's always done well in school. This guy, we're going to make sure he gets a high school education. So to have that money so he could start his junior year, his third year in high school, was so essential to her that she would take her harvest and basically sell that to raise the money to be able to send him to school or at least start the school year. And as it turns out, well, it wasn't able to pay for everything, for the full tuition cost. So during the course of the year, he keeps being sent home by the headmaster to bring more money back so he can stay in school. So the mother and the father, they're selling just essential things like their little small transistor radio. They'll sell a goat, they'll sell a chicken, so he can go back to school and stay in school for another couple of weeks or something. So this prize of education, when you think of that, well, how could she make that decision to sell this food that she can now feed the rest of her family throughout the year? But education is so important. And as Leonita says, in this time, you're basically nothing unless you have an education. And that's what they're counting on. This guy can then go get a better job, become an agriculture extension agent or something, help me here at home. But with that job, his younger sisters, he'll be able to help them also go to school. I also want to say the point that Karen made, and she mentioned water. If you're a farmer and you're a woman and your children, and you're going to the source of water, which may be a stream or a well that's a bit far away, maybe half a mile or a mile or 2 miles away, and you're going back and forth 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day, that's very time-consuming. It's very strenuous. So that doesn't leave you a lot of time then to do the farming. So these practices, and as she said, we take these things for granted. That is something that this is the way we're doing it. I'll just continue with that because at least I'm growing something, not knowing that by changing your practices, boy, you can have this greater increase in harvest.
It sounds like it was a real leap of faith.
Yes.
And we'll find out more about that. I'm going to take a short break right now. We're talking with Roger Thoreau, author of The Last Hunger Season. We have callers standing by waiting to talk to you, Roger, and they'll be doing that right after this break here on Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with Roger Thoreau, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, now senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and author of The Last Hunger Season, A Year in an African Farm Community on the Brink of Change. It's published by Public Affairs. A new trade paperback edition published this year features a new epilogue and a reading group guide. If you have a question or comment, contact us now. We're at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go to a caller on line two, Scott from Urbana. Thank you for waiting. You're on Focus.
Yeah, thank you, Jim, and the guest.
Thank you.
I'm glad I've had a little bit of a break here because the guy from Savoy really lit my fuse. The people that I've met in Africa during a couple of trips to Malawi are the most innately intelligent, hardworking, and thoughtful people I've ever been around. And so we all need to take care, and this is actually what my question is going to be about, to exert our privileged first world sort of mentality on the things that we see them do. And in fact, I guess my question is, the slippery slope to monoculture, corn and soybeans, the News Gazette, our local paper here today, has almost two full pages related to the corn economy in Central Illinois and ethanol in particular. And I guess I'd like to be a little more assured that the one-acre movement isn't just really a GMO and fertilizer additive sort of proposition. And I don't think that's the case, but I guess that's my challenge. There's kind of a standing joke amongst the you might call them the political elite in at least southeastern Africa about tractors thrown out through the countryside that no longer work because they don't have parts and pieces. So I'm really into this small group that's out of Michigan, actually, called Tillers International, that attempts to use sort of indigenous practices modified for agriculture. And so what can you tell me about the balance that the one-acre people are trying to run between using these modern techniques, but also in recognition of the drastically different soil conditions and environment that's over there in terms of the production of these crops? And I'll ring off and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for that question. And thanks also for pointing out that in your observations, precisely as mine and hopefully come through very distinctly in the book, that these farmers are this kind of innate intelligence that you talk about. It may not be book intelligence or school intelligence, but knowing they're in tune with their climate, their conditions, very smart farmers doing as much as they can, and the resourcefulness of them, that given the little resources that they have, what they're able to accomplish, with that in the limited nature, which is why they kind of suffer through this and endure the hunger season, but that they can kind of wring anything out of their poor soils. So it's a great question on the 1 acre fund. So they're not in most of sub-Saharan Africa, except say for South Africa, where there's GMO technology. Burkina Faso uses it for cotton. Elsewhere in sub-Saharan Africa, there's not really the GMO seeds aren't in the ground. There may be some research that's going on. Some of the countries are debating what to do, kind of working about setting up a framework and
considering that. One-acre fund isn't working with GMO seeds.
No,
right
not now. At all. So one-acre fund is just basically what they're trying to do is provide and assure this access in a timely basis of the proper seed, and it's hybrid seed, and there's so much advancement that can go on in Africa just with standard conventional hybrid seed and breeding. Say of all the corn grown in Africa, maybe less than 20% is with hybrid seeds. The others are kind of land seeds and varieties, and they're okay in certain areas, but as you mentioned, because of the soil conditions, because of pests, diseases, that they need some kind of updating and modernization of those seeds. And so that is coming through just standard hybrid breeding technology. And so it's to get to the farmers in this timely manner and in the amounts that they want for the land that they have of the seed that's proper for their elevation, for their soil conditions, and the availability of that. So that's all hybrid. So there's kind of no GMO aspect of their equation. And for the fertilizer, it's micro dosing. So it's the equivalent of, say, a Coca-Cola bottle cap or a beer bottle cap. of fertilizer per maize plant is all that they apply at the planting time. And for beans, it's a third. And they're very judicious in doing that because it's kind of the most expensive part of this loan, of this market package and market bundle that, they get from the 1 acre fund. And so you really see them bending over very carefully and measuring carefully this amount of fertilizer. So whatever they have can stretch for their entire acre, or however much they're
You also mentioned
planting.
That some of them are using manure,
right.
And there's nothing wrong with manure. They just actually don't have enough because they don't have enough livestock around to produce it.
Exactly. So I was going to mention that's great with the manure, the composting. So the 1 acre funds, they're introducing all of those concepts to it. So it's the microdosing of fertilizer, realizing, yeah, that's an expensive part of the operation. So what can you do kind of with on the organic front? So with composting, with using the manure. But if you only have one or two cows, and remember, the cow dung, they're using that for other purposes. It's their fuel. That they're using for their fires over which they're cooking. The dung is also what they use for the floors of their little houses. They'll also put it up on the outside walls of their houses as kind of this binding agent, you know, mixed with mud. So there's other uses that they have of that in addition to the fertilizer in the fields. And also, you had mentioned the thing about the monocropping and the reliance on maize. So corn is the traditional crop in that part of Western Kenya. They'll eat it as often as possible in different forms during the day. But 1 acre also realizing that, yeah, the diversity of the diet is really important. Once these farmers start having a surplus crop and they have some of their main crop, their stable crop of corn that they can sell, they're using that for then to buy seeds for second planting season. And in the second planting season, the short rain season, that's where they're planting their vegetables and their banana trees and other fruit trees that they're cultivating to diversify this diet. And so what happened in Western Kenya this last year, they were dealing with a significant maize disease that was spreading across Western Kenya. And the 1 acre fund said, okay, kind of to protect the farmers and also to protect, you know, the 1 acre funds for its repayments of its loan. Let's diversify and also plant millet and sorghum, sweet potatoes and orange flesh sweet potatoes, richer in vitamin A and the micronutrients. And so also looking to that, so to build this resilience and this diversification, diversify the diet, because it's not just a matter of growing enough food to feed the family throughout the year, but it's also to nourish the family and the proper nourishments and the micronutrients to prevent the stunting of the children, the malnourishment of the children. So these are all great and important questions that as time goes on, that the 1 acre fund then starts considering all these other aspects of the farmers' lives, but in consultation with the farmers. So it's not, they're all, so you're the farmers here, what is needed in your lives? How can we, what would you do to improve your farming, to improve the health of your families, the income of your families, the diversity of it? So more getting into chickens. When I went back this last time, so now 2 years after the reporting of the book, which was in 2011, Leonita, one of the farmers, all of a sudden she had four small pigs on her shamba, her farm. And so we got in a discussion of why the pigs is kind of an income-generating thing. But then also, yeah, there's the composting and things that they can use with all that as well. So it's quite fascinating to see their development.
We are talking on Focus on WILL with Roger Thoreau. He's the author of The Last Hunger Season, Tracing the Progress of Four Farm Families in Western Kenya, as they work with an organization called the 1 Acre Fund to work with better seed and better farming practices as they try to bring themselves out of subsistence farming. Roger will be at the U of I bookstore on Wright Street on the U of I Urbana campus at noon for a talk and a signing. Neglected to let you know that he's also speaking today at Spurlock Museum at 3 p.m. at the Knight Auditorium, where you'll be showing a preview of a documentary
based
on The Last Hunger Season. So there's been a lot of trips back to those four farmholds in Western Kenya, it sounds like.
Exactly. So we'll be showing clips, the documentaries, and post-production, kind of all the filming is done. Stunning footage, the farmers, the conversations the farmers are having, it's kind of all in their voices, totally from their perspective of the farmers. And so I think also very, very powerful storytelling that we're doing in the in the film. I also wanted to say on one point on seed. So it's all mainly local seed. So the seed companies that that One Acre Fund acquires the seed from are Kenya Seed, Western Seed, smaller seed companies that are coming up. So indigenous seed companies in Kenya that are growing seeds specifically for and tailoring them specifically for the smallholder farmers in Kenya with their soil conditions and their climatic conditions and altitude and things.
Let me go ahead with a patient caller, Paul from Champaign County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I wanted to start by saying that I do have a list here after all of this, that I think it's important to listen to some of the critics of the Green Revolution that, in its own terms, like Arundhati Roy, for it's a number of reasons. The cost of the inputs that go in with a more high-tech, if you call it that, agriculture, and the lack of the variety of seeds with a monoculture hybrid seed. And it probably wasn't stupid to plant different seeds if you didn't have a monoculture seed, if you didn't have one of the same. I mean, I walked soybean rows in my childhood and culled out corn out of the beans. Mm-hmm. I did that. And I think it's important to note that it might have been a reasonable thing to do if you had the time to cull afterwards and pick the one that was doing the best. That's a different approach to things, but I think it's worth mentioning as a possible problem. And as far as educating the unwashed, I mean, one of the problems is extension services are hooked in with the kind of structural adjustment. You kind of pointed that mm-hmm. a little bit with saying that people needed to do export low production manufacture instead of agriculture, and we'll supply them the grain. But also, it's true of people who are cash cropping, and if it's really tragic when people have a lot of cash crop on hand and the corn price goes down or whatever their monoculture cash crop is, and they can't afford to pay the money to buy the food that they need, and that's another input for hunger, it seems to me. The image that I can't get over from the very beginning of your show was when you were talking about food aid driving by warehouses full of a product in Ethiopia, and they're talking about buying local product and distributing it rather than shipping our corn and our grains in. But it's actually, you know, clearly it is a humanitarian venture when you're actually just using that as part of your price support structure for your corn mm. export. At the time of the Ethiopian famine, and this will be it, I guess, and you can react, Ethiopia was exporting tins of beef at the very time when people were starving, and you would find people who would say that, well, you know, this is important to do because they need the cash income, and perhaps that's true, but it's pretty surreal, it seems to me. It goes along with this driving by the full warehouses and helping the starving masses, it seems to me. So I appreciate your work, and but I think there's a lot of nuances in here that that probably need to be surveyed a little bit more in depth. And I thanks for the time,
Paul. Thank you very much. We have about 3 minutes left. How many nuances can you fit in?
Yeah, I'll try to run through them. Thank you very much, Paul. And we tried to deal with some of the nuances in the book. The Last Hunger Season, and then also on some of these issues of the kind of the failures or the problems of the Green Revolution, the food aid, the subsidies, that is, we deal with quite substantially in the first book that I did with my colleague at the Wall Street Journal, Scott Kilman. That book's Enough, Why the World's Poor Are Starving in an Age of Plenty. I think that came out in 2009. But in terms of the cost of seeds and fertilizer, that's always something that really needs to be to keep an eye on. Particularly for the smallholder farmers, which is why kind of these local or indigenous solutions are really important, both for the seed production and making maybe even small batches of seed available, so they don't have to buy 10 kilograms, but maybe just 2 kilograms to try different things.
In future years, these farmers working with the One Acre Fund, will they be buying seed or perhaps producing seed on their own and buying their own fertilizer, or will they continue to work with the One Acre Fund?
I think they're learning kind of the benefits of all this through the One Acre Fund, I think if there's other services that come in, so if there's other microfinance services are there so the farmers can access financing so they can go and purchase things on their own, they'll do that. These farmers, they also, and some of the listeners and callers probably also recognize this, these farmers, they save seed from one season to the next because they're uncertain, hey, am I going to have enough money to be able to buy new seed next year? They realize, okay, there's a bit of a burst. The seeds, you know, the new seeds will have a better germination rate. And they understand all that, and they're happy to see that. But it's always in the back of my mind, what if something happens in my family that I can't buy the seeds for next year? So they're saving the seed. And so I think that's an important nature of the local varieties of seed, of the hybrid seed, that they can indeed do that. So particularly with bean seeds, if they're going to save that and keep using that. But if they have the option, the financing that's there, they realize that if they can buy seeds every year, that that's something that they know they'll get better yields from. But Paul, those aspects of the cost, not that it becomes a burden for the farmers, that they go into debt, that's all something that really needs to be kept an eye on. And also the whole issue of the monocropping, the diversity that's needed for the diversity of their diet, the crop rotation that's really important for their soil, and then also the diversity of income, that they're not solely dependent on the price of corn, as you also mentioned, because that'll go up and down depending on if it's right after the harvest season, if it's several months later and there's less on the market and the prices are rising, and so that they're able to spread that out and have other income sources through crop diversification.
Well, that just puts us out of time. If you have more questions for Roger Thoreau, probably the best thing to do is to catch him at his two appearances on the University of Illinois campus today. Again, our apologies to our 8 p.m. listeners. It's a little too late. But noon today at the University of Illinois bookstore on Wright Street, he'll be giving a short talk and signing books as well. And at 3 p.m. at the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum, Roger will be talking about his book and showing a preview of a documentary made from The Last Hunger Season, A Year and an African Farm Community on the Brink of Change, and a book that presents a possible model for other programs that might help other small farmers in Africa in the future. Roger, thank you very much for coming on the program today on Focus.
Thank you for this great discussion and your interest in this. I appreciate it.
Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Tomorrow on Focus, what do you remember learning from the books you read as a child? Tomorrow on Focus, we'll meet two Illinois authors of children's books, Janet Rahecki and Marianne Malone, with different approaches to teaching children through books. That's on Wednesday's program. This is Focus on WILL.